he sent a supplementary letter to the bureau offices detailing what he knew, thanks entirely to Meredith, about the ringleader's wife. Ethel, used her husband's last name, had been married for 5 years at this time, 29 years of age, member of the Communist Party USA, possibly joining in 1938, knew about her husband's work with the Soviets. But although this description offered, as Bob fervently wanted to believe, a considerable amount of positive information, it wasn't enough. Not a single promising tip reached his desk. The identity of the female unsub remained an enigma. He needed to find another way to get to her. Desperate, Bob began grasping at straws. He theorized, despite the fact that the deciphered cable had clearly stated Christian name Ethel was Liberal's wife, that she might be involved with Barr. His rationale, as much as he had one, hinged on a belief that this network of fellow countrymen might also have liberated sexual ideals. A bourgeois concept like matrimony might not be too restrictive in Marxist circles. Thus began the investigation, as Bob would primly describe it, of Barr's women friends. It was quickly established that Barr didn't have a wife, but at the head of his list of many girlfriends, there was one long-time relationship. And when the Bureau started poking into Vivian Glassman's background, they found themselves following a trail similar to the ones they'd previously traveled while attempting to identify members of the ring. Her life had been lived in near lockstep with Barr's and Elitcher's, and even more tantalizingly, perhaps with Liberal's. She was the daughter of immigrants, attended City College, worked at the Army's Signal Corps laboratories at Fort Monmouth, had access to classified defense information, and had ties to communist groups. But as much as Bob wanted to make the match, he came to the conclusion that there was nothing that could tie her to the female unsub. Then, just as Bob was ready to surrender, a new bit of information came in. One of Barr's friends claimed that, in fact, he was married. Could his wife, a secret wife, since few people appeared to know about her, be Christian name Ethel? And what if, Bob now found himself wondering, and not for the first time, Barr was really Liberal? Had all the girlfriends just been one more bit of Moscow Center subterfuge to throw the enemy off the scent in the event they ever discovered the ringleader was married? To conceal that Joel Barr was the agent pulling the network strings? Elaine Goldfarb was the name of the woman alleged to have been Barr's wife, and the FBI pulled her biography apart. Yet in the end, Bob had to concede that Goldfarb and Barr had never been married, and there was nothing furtive about their relationship. True, they had lived together for a short time, but Goldfarb had not set eyes on Barr for 7 years. The premise that she was the elusive unsub he'd been hunting could not, even Bob had to agree, be logically sustained. "We came to a dead end on the investigation into Christian name Ethel," Bob decided, full of a certainty he'd live to regret. But there was still Max Elitcher. He was suddenly on the move, and the FBI, as Bob had instructed, was sticking closely to him. It was July 30th, 1948, a muggy midsummer morning, and Elitcher, his wife Helene, and their young daughter were in their two-door Chevy, driving from Washington up to New York. Elitcher had given notice to his superiors in the Naval Ordnance Department that he'd be leaving soon. A school friend, Morton Sobel, had helped him land a better-paying job at Reeves Instrument Company in New York. The purpose of this trip was to check out the progress on the new house in Queens the Elitchers would be moving into as of September. Its backyard bordered Sobel's home, and the convivial plan was for the Elitchers to be weekend house guests at the Sobels. They were heading through Baltimore when Helene Ellicher noticed the car trailing behind them. It was a dark sedan, and both the driver and the man next to him in the front seat wore ties, jackets, and fedoras. It was as identifying as any uniform, and she excitedly told her husband that the FBI was following them. Ellicher tried to lose the tail. He sped up. He slowed down. He switched lanes. The dark sedan relentlessly kept pace. Near Philadelphia, another team of FBI watchers took over. And for a while, the Ellichers appeared at ease. They hadn't spotted the new tail. But as he drove into New York City, coming down the expressway along the Hudson River, Ellicher looked into his rearview mirror and saw a dark sedan on his bumper. There were two beefy men sporting fedoras in the front seat. Ellicher quickly improvised a new plan. He wouldn't lead the FBI to his friend's home. Instead, he'd wait out the storm at his mother's apartment on Upper Lexington Avenue. If they wanted to arrest him, they could do it there. At least his family would be safe. It was a long, uneasy stay for the Ellichers. The husband and wife went repeatedly to the living room window, looking furtively up and down the street. The slightest noise, and they wondered if it was the sound of the FBI stomping up the steps, preparing to pound on the apartment door. Hours passed, but nothing happened. As the sky darkened, the Ellichers grew convinced the FBI had abandoned their surveillance. They'd be able to continue undetected to the Sobels in Queens. They were wrong. When the Ellichers arrived at their friend's home, agents William McCarthy and John Ward were still on their backs. But it didn't matter. The two FBI men did not stay for long. The next morning, Bob read their surveillance report. It should be stated that on the trip from Manhattan to the Sobels' home, it was confirmed without a doubt that the Ellichers were tail-conscious, and therefore the surveillance was discontinued. And so Bob never knew what happened next. Morton Sobel was furious. How could his guest have led the FBI to his doorstep? What if they come charging in and arrest you? With or without a warrant, they'll have the excuse they need to search my home, he worried. The two families sat down to an uneasy dinner. Conversation was difficult. They were on high alert, listening for a sudden noise, an unnatural sound that rose above the passing traffic. Max and Mort, two old friends, could not help feeling that this might be their last supper as free men. The table was cleared, and still nothing. No intrusions, no arrests. But Sobel's nerves were frayed. He took Ellicher aside and spoke to him in a low voice. He had some material in the house that was, Ellicher would remember his saying, too good to throw away. But it was too dangerous to keep it, not with the chance that the FBI could barge in at any moment. He needed to get it to Rosenberg now, and he wanted his friend to come with him. He was too tired to drive into Manhattan alone. In the car, Sobel convinced the reliably subservient Ellicher to drive. But first, Sobel took a small canister, the size that would hold a roll of 35mm film, out of his jacket pocket and placed it in the glove compartment. Ellicher drove carefully, and all the while his eyes were constantly darting to the rearview mirror, checking for unwanted company. He followed his friend's directions, heading down the East River Drive. Sobel told him when to exit, and then guided him to a deserted stretch in Lower Manhattan. It had an odd name for a city street, a woman's name, Catherine Slip. "Park," Sobel ordered. From the car, the two men could see the dark ribbon of the East River in the distance. The night seemed unnaturally quiet. Ellicher sat behind the wheel as Sobel made his way on foot toward Knickerbocker Village. So Bell walked the two blocks neither fast nor slow. The film canister was now deep in his pocket. Meanwhile, Ellicher waited. He quickly lost track of the time. Minutes? An hour? A lifetime? In his churning mind, it was as if a chaotic chorus was screaming mad, incoherent thoughts. He felt completely unnerved. Then the car door opened, and Sobel climbed in.
"What did Julie think about it?"
his friend swiftly asked, not even trying to disguise the panic in his words. Sobel, though, was all calm.
"Julie says there's nothing to worry about," he answered.
And there wasn't. The Bureau's watchers had already returned their car to the garage. The evening came and went without either Bob or Sasha knowing just how close the Bureau had come to breaking the ring. In their blindness, the hunters and the hunted continued on. 23. Then, without any warning, the high-flying investigation went into a tailspin. For Bob and Meredith, there was the before and then the after. And in the aftermath, America's hegemony came to an unexpected end, and the world changed forever. Bob would always remember the day he'd heard the shocking news, and the deep sense of personal failure that swiftly followed. His eventful week had started off badly, and in that still innocent time, he might very well have thought things couldn't have gotten any worse. Bob had been tethered to his desk at headquarters, poring over the latest batch of decrypts, when, in a sudden flash of insight, a piece in the puzzle fell into place. The code name of the KGB agent mentioned in one of the new cables had been gnawing at him for days. Why did he keep returning to it, he wondered. But Bob couldn't find the answer. The connection eluded him. Then there it was. He had seen it before, more or less. The name in the cable was similar to the cover name of a Soviet operative the Bureau had unearthed in a previous investigation. He ran to check the files, and, digging feverishly, he tracked it down. The two names were so close it couldn't be an accident. They had to be the same man. It was a finding, Bob was firmly convinced, that would open up new investigative paths, reveal previously undetected Soviet espionage activities. But beyond the operational significance, it was also a personal triumph. Bob had come up with this new, important clue on his own. For once, he hadn't relied on Meredith to make the breakthrough. They were a team, but nonetheless it bothered the competitive Bob that Meredith had been leading the way. Bob felt he'd be able to show the codebreaker that he wasn't the only one who had the acuity to penetrate Moscow Center's secrets. Flush with pride, Bob hurried to Arlington Hall. And all the way there he was beaming. "Waiting for compliments," he'd candidly recall. Meredith listened with an impassive concentration. When he finally spoke, he was, Bob would concede with gratitude, gentle. But at the same unflinching time he made it clear that Bob had gotten it all wrong. "The problem," explained Meredith, seeming truly embarrassed to be in the role of teacher correcting the naive pupil, "was that Bob didn't know Russian. Although the two names did look alike, they were worlds apart when pronounced correctly. There was no connection at all." Chagrined, Bob slunk out of his friend's office. Over the days that followed, the rebuke, despite the elaborate politeness with which it had been delivered, continued to sting. But Bob was never one to brood for too long. He possessed too much self-confidence. In time, he managed to find the philosophy to shrug it off. Looking back at the conversation, he now could be amused at my own stupidity. And then, without warning, this rosy perspective, along with everything else he'd been working on, or so it seemed at the terrible time, no longer amounted to much. The stunning news, as Bob would say with a measure of momentousness as much as shock, changed everything. From their base in Alaska, the B-29s of the 175th Weather Reconnaissance Squadron routinely patrolled a patch of the Pacific that stretched all the way to Japan, before circling back over the Arctic just windward of the Soviet Union. As the B-29s flew below the jet stream, their specially designed fuselage ducts scooped up the air through paper filters. The planes were, in Air Force parlance, sniffers. The unit's secret mission, to detect long-range atomic explosions. On September 3, 1949, one of the squadron's B-29s flying east of the Kamchatka Peninsula gathered evidence that set off the plane's red warning lights. Back at the base, measurements of the filter paper residue confirmed what had previously been unthinkable: radioactivity that was the result of atomic fission. 5 days earlier, on an isolated grassy steppe in northeast Kazakhstan, the Soviet Union had detonated an atom bomb. For 4 years, the United States had been the only nation with this unprecedented weapon in its arsenal. America had dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima, more than 140,000 dead, and Nagasaki, more than 70,000 dead, confident that no country on earth could respond with equally dreadful force. Now that monopoly was broken. There were two atomic superpowers. President Truman, though, didn't believe it. It seemed impossible to him that those Asiatics, as he dismissed the upstart Russian scientists, could build a device as sophisticated as an atom bomb. Adamant, he refused to make a public announcement until the members of the detection committee signed a statement, one of the participants recalled, to the effect that they really believed the Russians had done it. And even after the committee dutifully affirmed the evidence was irrefutable, the president grumbled that German scientists in Russia did it. That was the only explanation that made any sense. After all, just weeks earlier he'd received a report from the CIA repeating its previous estimate that the most probable date for a Soviet atomic bomb was mid-1953. But Bob, who had learned of the disaster at a hastily called intelligence briefing that swiftly turned as mournful as a wake, had another suspicion. And while people left the session in stunned silence, their eyes averted from one another, Bob saw things clearly. His collaboration with Meredith over the past year, all the leads he'd been following, had convinced him that he was not inventing conspiracies where none existed. A possible link between Enormos and wartime nuclear fission. He believed, just as Meredith believed, that Russian scientists had been aided in their effort to build it by information stolen from the United States. But believing was not the same as knowing, or, for that matter, proving. It was a difficult time. His conjectures weighing heavy on his shoulders, Bob was summoned the next day to another meeting at headquarters. It would be 3 weeks before a somber Truman would share the news with the American people, but an interagency committee had already been formed to try to get a handle on the implications of the Russian bomb, as the shell-shocked intelligence specialists put it. Lish Whitson, the studious new chief of the espionage section, was the Bureau's representative, and before he faced the other committee members he wanted to hear from his own unit supervisors. Three of Bob's colleagues had already taken their places at the round table, and as soon as Bob entered the room he could tell by the stony stares that greeted him that something was not right. Whitson, breathing anger and frustration, started things off with a barrage of hostile questions. They were all aimed at Bob. Every one of them, each in its separate yet accusatory way, wanted an answer to pretty much the same thing. Had the Russians built their bomb using information they had stolen from us? And if they had, why weren't the culprits behind bars? Bob sat there, absorbing the attack, waiting for Whitson to finish. But from the opening salvo, he'd understood what was going on. He was the man, it was well known in the Bureau, who was leading the charge to track down Soviet spies. It didn't matter that, if scientific information had indeed been taken, the thefts had occurred during the war, long before Bob had gotten on the case. This was not a time for logic. Whitson wanted a scapegoat, and since the Bureau didn't have an actual Russian to fit with a noose, they'd settle by placing the rope around the neck of the next best thing, the supervisor of the Soviet espionage desk. At last it was Bob's turn to speak. He did his best to fight back, but it wasn't much of a battle. He couldn't reveal too much about what was going on at Arlington Hall, what Meredith had discovered about Enormos. Even the president was still in the dark about the operation. Flailing away, he offered a painfully brief catalogue of espionage activities that resulted in some information, probably of minor value, being transmitted to the Russians. But in the end, with a condemned man's resigned candor, he had to admit that it wasn't possible for us to assess accurately how much direct help these penetrations had been to Soviet scientists who had fashioned the Russian A-bomb. His direct answer to Whitson's direct question was a hapless I don't know. When the torturous meeting finally came to an end, Bob left with his head hung low. He felt he'd let the Bureau, no, the nation, down by failing to round up the Soviet agents Meredith's magic had revealed. Worse, his sense of shame was compounded because his defeat appeared irreparable. He'd never find the definitive proof he needed to track down the atomic spies. And he'd never be able to stop them before they made off with more of this country's secrets. Yet Truman, while muddying the matter with his xenophobic slur, had nevertheless been onto something when he'd argued that making an atomic device was a complicated business. Uranium would be at the fissionable core of the prototype weapon, but one critical manufacturing problem was that uranium in its natural state is made up of two isotopes, U-235 and U-238. Isotopes are like fraternal rather than identical twins. They're elements with the identical chemical makeup, but at the same time they're unique. And, as with twins, it's these variations, however small, that make all the difference. U-235 was the more highly radioactive twin, and the one that packed the wallop necessary to power a chain reaction that'd culminate in a nuclear explosion. Only it was rare. In a chunk of natural uranium, less than 1% of the entire element would be the sleek U-235. The remainder was the heavier, inert U-238. The scientists working on the bomb were faced with a daunting technical challenge. How do you separate these two conjoined uranium twins? How can the vital U-235 be extracted from the uranium element? American and British scientists had experimented with a variety of complex methods: electromagnetic separation, chemical extraction, and gaseous diffusion. Gaseous diffusion, in the original theories scientists presented, was a sort of Rube Goldberg project involving a high-pressure system with pumps and tubes arranged in an interconnected cascade of more than 4,000 stages. Uranium gas would course through this network, making its way through a series of membranes with submicroscopic openings, and the lighter U-235 would complete the journey before its heavier twin. It was such a promising theory that even before all the glitches had been worked out, the Manhattan Project had agreed to build a $100 million gaseous diffusion plant in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And now Meredith sat at his isolated desk, reading a KGB cable announcing the delivery of a theoretical paper on the top-secret gaseous diffusion process. For while Bob had been lumbering about like a bereaved man, Meredith had been working. After laboring long hours well into the night, he had succeeded in deciphering a series of cables starting back in February 1944 between the New York Residentura and Moscow Center that all involved the activities of an agent codenamed Rest. A message dated June 15, 1944, fused all his inchoate findings into a single cry of alarm. Received from Rest the third part of report SN-12, efferent fluctuations in esteem, and here Meredith had stumbled for a moment, he couldn't unlock several code groups, diffusion method, work his specialty. With that, Meredith knew, and all his suspicions became certainties. Just as Bob knew when he read the deciphered cable, reporting what the agent codenamed Rest had delivered. "It became immediately obvious to me," he'd say, the words crackling with resolve and anger, "that the Russians had indeed stolen crucial research from us, and had undoubtedly used it to build a bomb." As if in an instant, Bob was lifted from his doldrums. His theories had been proven. There were no longer speculations, but cold, hard facts. And there was an additional reason spurring him on. Just a day earlier, at an intelligence briefing he'd attended, a secret had been shared, albeit in purposefully imprecise layman's terms, that gave his activities a new critical urgency. In the aftermath of Russia's detonation of an atomic device, President Truman had issued the order to build a new super bomb, a hydrogen bomb. "Go to it and fast," the president had instructed the Atomic Energy Commission. Bob now feared that the Soviet spies who had stolen the Enormo's secrets would make off with the plans for this new super weapon, too, unless he and Meredith stopped them. In his revitalized mood, he swiftly made an operational decision. Elitcher, Sobel, Christian name Ethel, all the inquiries into the potential members of Liberal's ring were to be put aside. That investigation suddenly seemed to Bob to be a diversion, and at best one that offered the prospect of only small rewards. There was nothing in their backgrounds that linked any of these suspects to atomic research. His priority was to track down the spies who had stolen the atomic secrets, Russian agents who could very well still be in place, pilfering the secrets of this new superweapon. His first step in this renewed hunt was to find the answer to the question that now burned inside him with the fiery glow of a vendetta. Who is Rest? 24. The world of a KGB agent runner was one of frequent change. Stay too long in one place, working one set of Joes, and the greater the likelihood the opposition will get a bead on you. And so Moscow Center had pulled Sasha from his posting in New York, praised him for a job well done, and before too long had sent him off on a new assignment. On September 27, 1947, Sasha's destination was the Nag's Head pub, just across from the Wood Green tube station in North London, where he was to meet Rest for the first time. Every agent runner has his own handwriting, that is, his own style of tradecraft, and Sasha was fond of bars for making visual contacts with his agents. He could wait without attracting attention. What could be a more natural cover than bellying up to the bar, glass in hand? While at the same time, he could keep an eye on the door to see if the opposition's watchers had tagged along. The Nag's Head offered all this and more. It was on a busy street, directly across from a bus stop, the perfect observation post for a discreet reconnoiter before entering. Inside, three low-ceilinged rooms ran into one another, and each was smoky, dark, and crowded. Boozy voices roaring up in a constant din on this Saturday night that made eavesdropping impossible. Another blessing, a bell above the door conveniently jingled when someone entered. Yet despite all the operational cards he was holding, on the day of the meet, Sasha was uncharacteristically wary. Just 3 months earlier, newly arrived in Moscow after his 5.5 years in America, he had been summoned to the center and found himself facing an impassive Lieutenant General Sergei Romanovich Savchenko, the head of intelligence, and Leonid Kvasnikov, his old boss in New York, who had become the head of the KGB's 10th Directorate for Scientific and Technical Intelligence. They advised him of his new mission. Comrade Feklisov was to take control of the agent who was one of the key elements in the construction of the Soviet A-bomb. The agent, codenamed Rest, had previously worked at Los Alamos and had made regular deliveries of secret materials that had proven essential to Russian scientists. In July 1946, he returned to England as head of theoretical research at Harwell, the center for the British atomic weapons program. For the past 15 months, Rest had been out of touch, but he'd recently sent word that he had new material. Sasha was to be assigned to the London embassy, once more masquerading under diplomatic cover, to handle the reactivation of Rest. He was specifically ordered to satisfy all his requests. And at the same time, Sasha was to convey to Rest specific questions from the Soviet team that was trying to keep pace with the Americans' surprisingly public development of the new superweapon, the hydrogen bomb. The session with the two spymasters concluded with a mission statement that was delivered with an icy hardness. An arrest would be in and of itself a serious setback. Any kind of problem could be potentially disastrous for Soviet scientific research. Sasha understood. He'd received a warning, and with so much hanging in the balance, he did not need to be informed of the penalty if he was the cause of Rest's apprehension. Sasha proceeded to the 8 p.m. meet with a professional's care, leaving, as was his practice, hours in advance. He had always preferred to act alone. His customary maxim, the more agents at a secret rendezvous, the greater the risk. But this time, with the stern warning he'd received in the Lubyanka still ringing in his ears, Sasha decided a more cautious tradecraft was necessary. After cabling the center for permission, he'd recruited Volodya, the good-natured young embassy chauffeur, to act as both his legman and babysitter. And so, with Volodya watching his back, he traveled to the southern edge of London before reversing course and heading north by a combination of buses and underground trains. When Sasha had set out, a thin sun had been shining through the autumn clouds, but by the time he emerged from the wood-green station, the sky was dark, and the operational gods had further blessed the evening with a concealing fog. Still, Sasha waited. Prudent tradecraft required that he look before he leaped. If the opposition had been trailing him, or, an even more dire thought, if they had been following Rest, their surveillance teams would be in position along the street in front of the Nag's Head. He walked slowly to the bus stop and stood there pretending to read the newspaper, while all the time praying a bus wouldn't come before he had time to check for all the watchers' telltale signs. He looked for smoke trailing from the exhausts of parked cars, vans with an array of antennas on their roofs, or clumps of drinkers scattered on the street who never touched their pints or exchanged a cheery word with their mates. He kept a sharp eye but saw nothing that gave him any cause for alarm. With an impressive punctuality, at precisely 8 p.m., a tall man with a thin wisp of blond hair above a broad dome of a forehead that seemed high and wide enough to hold an encyclopedia of scientific secrets entered the pub. He walked with a martial erectness, shoulders back like a soldier on parade. He was the very image of the photograph Sasha had scrutinized at Moscow Center of the agent codenamed Rest. Sasha waited an additional 5 minutes or so just to be sure no one was trailing behind, and then he crossed the street to join the lively Saturday night crowd inside the Nag's Head. Rest sat on a high stool, a beer in front of him, as he skimmed the pages of the Tribune. The newspaper had been the recognition signal ordered by Moscow Center, but Sasha's stomach dropped precipitously as he realized the choice had been an operational mistake. The Tribune was too left-wing for a scientist with the highest security clearance to be seen reading in these suspicious Cold War days. Sasha carried a book with a red cover clutched in his hand, another previously ordained sign, and Rest acknowledged his arrival with a small nod of his head. Sasha quickly looked away and found a place at the other end of the bar. And once again he waited. He knew this was a crucial moment. If the enemy had been following, now would be when they'd enter the bar. Either all his fears would remain locked in his imagination, or in an instant his worst nightmare would become very real. Suddenly the bell above the door jingled, and in Sasha's shaky mind it clanged like a fire alarm. The door flung open and two men walked in. In a series of observations that passed so rapidly as to be a single instant in his mind, Sasha saw that they were old enough to be retirees. Their faces shone with the rosy glow that comes from a night's drinking, and with voices jolly and booming, they greeted the bartender like old friends when they ordered their pints. Although never partial to beer, Sasha took a long, relieved swallow from his glass, and for once the tepid, bitter taste was a pleasure. Rest was the first to leave his seat. There was a corner of the dark room where the wall was decorated with framed photographs of British pugilists, their fists raised menacingly as if ready to do battle, and, as per the plan, he walked over and focused his attention on them. The center had decreed that in addition to the recognition signals, a word code should be exchanged. Before leaving Moscow, Sasha had memorized the dialogue. "The stout is not as it should be," was his line. "Nothing can compare to Guinness," would be Rest's response. But once he arrived in London, the local resident informed him that Rest had vetoed the exchange. He had taken it upon himself to come up with a new script, to which Sasha had agreed without protest. Once in the field, the agent, not the handler, is always in control. He sets the rules. When Sasha approached, Rest murmured, "I think the best British heavyweight of all times is Bruce Woodcock." He said the words as if he were merely thinking out loud, talking to no one in particular. His eyes remained glued to the photographs. Sasha replied, "Oh no, Tommy Farr is certainly the best." Rest didn't continue the argument. He returned to the bar, but suddenly he was in a hurry. He finished his beer in a single gulp, paid his tab, wished the barman a good evening, and was on his way. Sasha moved toward the window, a man finding a place to stand. But his gaze looked out toward the foggy street. There was no one on Rest's tail as he walked slowly down the block. Sasha caught up with him several minutes later. "Hello. My name is Eugene," he said, adding one more cover name to a lifetime of aliases. "I'm happy to see you." "Hello, Eugene. I'm happy as well," said Rest with a smile that seemed genuine. "I thought you'd forgotten me." The two men shook hands and continued down the nighttime block, talking all the way as cars hummed along the high road. It is the duty of case officers to get to know their agents, and it is a practice that is driven by more than mere curiosity or good manners. It is necessary for survival. A professional has the training and the experience to sort through the clutter of his agent's life and make judgments about security, about what might set off the chain of events that will culminate in the enemy's counterintelligence team crashing through the door. On that first evening stroll through the foggy streets of Haringey, Sasha peppered Rest with questions. He wanted to know about the scientist's life at Harwell. The British Atomic Research Center, as Rest described it, was a compound surrounded by barbed wire fences and checkpoints, a world of endless security requirements. But his handler was cheered to hear that Rest had moved into a nearby boarding house, and, thanks to the generous salary he earned, had his own car. Sasha also discussed the risks Rest would be taking, and in doing so he had to walk the fine line that is the handler's constant balancing act. He wanted the product, but he didn't want his agent to get caught. "How will you be able to take out documents, calculations, graphs, and sketches?" he asked. "What if they are discovered while checking your ID card just as you are leaving Harwell?" Rest was full of daring.
"Simple," he said, as if he really believed it was. "I'll tell them, but no one ever said I have no right to take my own notes with me. I work non-stop for 24 hours, and an idea can come to me at home just as easily as in the lab."
Sasha, his interest purely operational, also wanted to know with whom his agent was sleeping. One of his greatest fears, lodged deep in his anxious mind by the spymasters at the center, was that Rest would get caught in a honey trap dangled by the opposition. Rest's answer was vague, both hesitant and embarrassed. Sasha thought the implication was that he went to prostitutes from time to time. The handler decided not to press. Instead, he tried a different tack.
"Why don't you get married? Aren't you tired of being a bachelor?"
Sasha wanted the suggestion to sound genial, the advice of one concerned friend to another. But his professional's mind was thinking that a wife would be a useful bit of cover. Marriage conveys trustworthiness. With a wife by his side, Rest would get invited to social occasions at Harwell. There'd be more opportunities to meet the sort of people who would further his career.
"I think about it from time to time," Rest said. "But you know I'm walking through a minefield. One false move and it will all blow up. I can accept the worst-case scenario, but I can't involve a wife and children."
Sasha listened, and suffered through a moment's guilt. He felt ashamed by his small attempt to manipulate his agent's life for his own reasons. But in the next instant he was once again the KGB professional. He had a list of memorized questions that had been passed on to him by the center. Like all the graduates of the KGB spy school, his memory had been drilled until he could repeat the license plates of at least 9 cars that passed in rapid succession. But this was a completely different task. He had been tutored in atomic theory before he'd left Moscow, but it had been basic concepts. The questions posed by the Russian scientists were quite specific, and full of terms that might just as well have been in an incomprehensible language. Sasha could not trust himself to remember more than 5 of their carefully crafted inquiries. Rest listened without interrupting. His answers, too, were patient. He spoke in a slow, calm voice, while at the same time gauging his handler's reaction. When he saw that Sasha seemed lost, he'd start over again, repeating the information with a deliberate precision. Sasha's concentration was immense. He filed each response, he'd say, in different drawers within my memory. Yet the exchanges were taut, filled with the constant fear that if he made a single mistake, forgot a phrase, or erred with a number, the center would extract an unforgiving punishment. His only hope was that after he returned to the Residentura, he'd empty each drawer one by one
and put on paper what had been said.
When the five specific questions had been answered, Sasha gave Rest a list of additional, more complex technical areas that the scientists working in Laboratory Number 2 wanted him to explore. The list was written on cigarette paper. It could easily be swallowed. He instructed Rest to bring the information at their next meet. Rest read the list.
No problem. You'll get all this next time.
Then he handed the slip of paper back to Sasha. He didn't need it. It was all locked in his mind. Rest's dossier had stressed his nearly photographic memory, but still Sasha was uneasy. Yet he decided that he could not at this first meeting challenge his Joe. It was more important that a bond of trust develop between them. As the meet was about to end, Sasha asked for the documents Rest was carrying. The agent had wanted to hand them over as soon as they'd left the pub, but Sasha had refused. It was another of the inviolate rules of Moscow Center Tradecraft that exchanges occur only at the very last moment. If the opposition suddenly emerged from the shadows, the agent would stand a better chance of talking his way out of the incriminating predicament than if the secrets were found on a foreigner. Rest handed over a notebook with about 40 pages in small but carefully legible handwriting. It revealed the latest information on the workings and manufacture of the plutonium bomb.
"Thank you," said Sasha as he was about to leave.
"My pleasure," answered Rest. "I shall always be indebted to you."
Then they went off in separate directions, handler and agent disappearing into the night's fog. Over the next 2 years, Sasha would meet with Rest every 3 or 4 months. They would meet at pubs or at the cinema or on the street, using brush passes to exchange secret documents. For a while, the center grew concerned that the enemy was on to Rest. It was decided that a DLB, the professional shorthand for a dead letter box, would offer greater security. A KGB asset, an Englishman by birth, lived in a cottage surrounded by a well-trimmed hedge on a quiet suburban street. Rest was instructed to toss a package containing his next delivery over the hedge and onto the lawn. But at the last minute, the center overruled its own plan. Despite the risks, the spymasters ordered Sasha to continue his meets with Rest. The yield was too valuable to jeopardize. And as Bob and Meredith began their hunt for Rest, an ocean away, Sasha prepared for his next face-to-face rendezvous with the very spy who had just come into their sights. 25. From Bob's office in the Justice Department headquarters, it was a short walk up Constitution Avenue through the bureaucratic heart of official Washington to the broad limestone building on 19th Street. On the outside, the structure was as solid as a mausoleum, and inside it was no more comforting. There was a maze of dimly lit corridors whose walls were painted in a lugubrious shade of green, and the officious clickety-clack of typewriters reverberated from behind closed doors. During the war, a cluster of high-ceilinged rooms had been home to the newly formed Joint Chiefs of Staff and their army of aides, but with the peace they had moved on to grander suites in the Pentagon. The offices had been recently taken over by another breed of intrepid warriors, the Atomic Energy Commission, AEC. And now Bob, not knowing where else to begin, had come here hoping to get the help he needed to find the Russian spy known as Rest. The cable Meredith had deciphered offered, Bob was convinced, one potentially promising clue. It stated that Rest had passed on to his handler the third part of Report SN, and while Meredith had struggled to get the complete title, he had managed to make out that it concerned fluctuations in the diffusion method. Bob decided that if he could identify the actual report, Then he might be able to get something that could direct him to the spy who'd passed the document on to the KGB. Specifics still eluded him. He was running on pure instinct. After making a few calls, he'd been told to try the AEC. They had custody of all the Manhattan Project files. Yet even as he walked across town on that late October day in 1949, Bob was gripped by the disturbing awareness that he might not get too much cooperation. For one thing, he couldn't reveal why he was looking for the report, how the fragmentary title had come to his attention, or even the fact that the KGB cable sent from New York had been dated June 15, 1944, and therefore that was why it seemed likely that the report had also been written about that date. Adding to his uncustomary level of professional trepidation, he knew he'd be entering a realm that was beyond his grasp. The prospect of using some scientific mumbo-jumbo about fluctuations in the diffusion method as his avenue of attack had him seriously doubting he was up to the task. The best he could do was remind himself that he'd won Meredith over. These AEC pointy heads couldn't be more difficult, or for that matter more brilliant, than his new friend at Arlington Hall. He'd come a long way from the days when his biggest intellectual challenge was hammering away with a pickaxe in the dark pit of an Idaho silver mine, he once again reflected with some amusement. It took Bob a bit of doing, a judicious mixture of his natural charm and what he called his G-man stare, to get the AEC officials to agree to look through their files. But once they went into action, it didn't take them long to find the document. All the pieces neatly fit. It was dated June 6, 1944, and titled Fluctuations and the Efficiency of a Diffusion Plant. Bob thumbed through the pages, more a reflexive gesture than any determined hunt, with only a faint hope of finding something incriminating. All he discovered were dense paragraphs, often mixed with mathematical formulae, and he swiftly came to the conclusion that the entire report was as incomprehensible to him as the encoded cables that Meredith somehow managed to decipher. Perhaps the AEC official, his identity a lost footnote to this story, saw the bewilderment on Bob's face, and that was why he offered a brief and indulgently simplistic explanation of how the diffusion process was essential to manufacture the sort of uranium necessary to create an atom bomb. Bob listened, and while he didn't follow all the science, he did grasp the bottom line of what the official was telling him. This was precisely the sort of valuable information that this government wouldn't want the Russians to have. Bob next focused his attention on Part 3 of the report, but it was no less daunting. The section was headed, The Effects of Fluctuations in the Flow of N2. He remembered enough of his high school chemistry to know that N2 was nitrogen, but the rest of the section was way beyond anything he'd learned in school. He gave up quickly. His cursory tour of the report over, Bob returned to the cover page. And there it was. An author was listed. A K. Fuchs. Bob knew that simply because this K. Fuchs had written the report, that didn't necessarily mean he'd handed the report to the Russians. Someone else could just as easily have stolen the document. Still, grasping at whatever sliver of encouragement he could, Bob remembered that the cable had described Rest by stating that work, and here Bob assumed that KGB meant the diffusion process, was his specialty. Who, he asked himself, would be more of a specialist than the author of the report? Bob at once decided his next step would be to identify this K. Fuchs. It would be too much to hope that Fuchs was Rest, but he should at least be able to give Bob an idea of who had access to the document. Despite all his initial apprehension, Bob felt he'd accomplished something. He had no definitive answers, but he had determined the direction he'd be taking. and experience had taught him that was all a field man could ever do, keep putting one foot in front of the other until he reached his destination. Standing still killed more investigations than anything else. In this optimistic mood, Bob waited for a photocopy of the report to be made. Once he had it, he'd head back to his office and direct his troops to chase down all they could about Kay Fuchs. He was eager to get going, but he had time to kill, and so he absently picked up the file folder that had held the report. It was crammed with other documents, and on the file cover was the designation MSN. Why did those three letters trigger something in his mind, Bob wondered. Then he remembered. Inked across the front page of the report that he'd just read was a handwritten MSN 12. Okay, he now deduced, it had been the 12th report in the MSN series. But what was MSN? The letters MSN, the clerk explained when he returned with the photocopied pages, denoted documents prepared by the group of British scientists who had come to New York during the early days of the war to work on atomic energy research. It was late November 1943, just as the SS Andes was preparing to sail from Liverpool, when a protective detail of military police led 15 men in civilian clothes on board. Before the bewildered captain could complain, he was handed an envelope marked Secret. Inside was a brief note written beneath an impressive Whitehall letterhead and bearing the even more impressive signature of a cabinet member. It was imperative, the note stiffly informed, that these passengers arrive safely in America. Nothing less than the entire Allied war effort was at stake. Over the tense days that followed, as the captain steered a circuitous path west toward Virginia across an Atlantic patrolled by German U-boats, he could only wonder as to the identity of his last-minute arrivals. Were they soldiers? No, they didn't have the look. Nor did he think they were pilots. And they certainly weren't sailors. Perhaps, he finally decided, they were civil servants who were working with the Yanks on lend-lease shipments. That would explain why they were so crucial to winning the war. Yes, he congratulated himself, that had to be it. He was wrong. They were much more important than he had imagined, or could ever have imagined. They were scientists who had been hand-picked by J. Robert Oppenheimer, the director of the Manhattan Project. They were chosen to work with a team at Columbia University to solve the remaining questions in the essential gaseous diffusion manufacturing process. If they could not provide answers to the engineers from the Kellex Corporation, whose multi-million-dollar facility was already under construction in Tennessee, the Manhattan Project would be unable to produce the specific uranium needed, and America would not be able to build an atomic bomb. 6 years later, as Bob studied the boat's passenger manifest, he suspected that one of the 15 British scientists was also a Russian spy. After the initial soft-pedaling round of burrowing, Bob's team had discovered plenty of reasons not only for suspicions, but for wrenching concerns. The group of British scientists included more than its fair share, as one bureau memo put it, of big names. Many of them émigrés from Nazi Germany, they had studied atomic theory with Max Born in Edinburgh, which was like studying gravity with Newton, and in the process had helped to reinvent physics. After their time in New York, several of them had also been recruited to work in key positions at the secret compound in Los Alamos, New Mexico, where the atomic weapon had been constructed. They were all precisely the sort of well-placed, knowledgeable agents the enemy would want to recruit. It was such a ghastly possibility that Bob's mind rebelled against it. He did not want to believe that any of these British scientists, no doubt vetted first by MI5 and then by the Manhattan Project authorities, had all along been working for the Russians. But then Meredith called. In his usual, tentative, almost self-effacing way, the codebreaker told Bob that he had something you might want to see if you're not too busy. Bob accepted the latest decrypt from his friend.